Tomorrow only 72.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
You have one of the largest censorship systems in our history, if not the largest. It's been called Orwellian by lower court judges. And what the court is saying is that we won't hear you on this issue because you're not the right litigants.
That is legal expert Jonathan Turley on today's decision announced just hours ago by the United States Supreme Court that greenlights the Biden censorship team to have free rein to lean on America's social media companies to hold back information from the American public on the eve of a presidential election. It is nothing more or less than exactly that. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I want to start out by saying a few things about what the Supreme Court decided not to decide today. They simply kicked this case back. And as Professor Turley said, they said, well, you're not the right folks to bring this case. You don't have standing. And by the way, you're asking the Supreme Court to take a look at all this complicated conversation that went on between federal government agencies and the social media companies, the biggest ones. We're talking about Twitter, or what is now known as X. We're talking about Facebook, now known as Meta, and Google, and every other one, and the kind of censorship that they engaged in that became most notable about 4 years ago during the middle of the pandemic, when the administration, especially once Joe Biden took office, said, we're going to tell those companies we don't want certain voices, we don't want certain information to reach the eyeballs and the ears of the American public. But let me get to that in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to take part in the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day, and you're invited to come on. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, maybe you believe that censorship by the government of the public is a great idea. If you're that kind of naysayer, you will go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in today's X poll. Tomorrow night, the presidential debate. It'll be Joe Biden, I know, the nursing home candidate, against Donald Trump, the best president of the 21st century. And that's happening tomorrow night. And they went along with all of Joe's limitations. No studio audience at all. Joe wanted to be all by himself. He wants to be president of the United States for another 4 years, but he doesn't want any actual citizens standing in the studio, only his team. And then, of course, there's Donald Trump, who's done a great job. And every time he holds a rally, tens of thousands of people show up. A lot of us have questioned whether or not Joe has what it's going to take to last even 90 minutes against Donald Trump. And I know that some people are trying to downplay one or downplay the other. The fact is, I'm going to stick to my position. I think Trump is going to mop the floor with Joe Biden, and he deserves it. He's been a terrible president. He has damaged this country irreparably in some cases. He has invited an invasion of this country. He has driven inflation to insane highs. People's paychecks have not caught up. And all you get from the White House is, oh, all that economic stuff, that's just your imagination. As Joe Biden told one interviewer from the Chicken Noodle News Network, CNN, oh, people have the money. They just don't want to spend it. Those are his actual words. He doesn't believe inflation exists. Of course, Joe hasn't gassed up a car in a while. Joe doesn't go to the grocery store. Joe doesn't have to worry about his paychecks because he's a multi-millionaire, thanks mostly to the corrupt dealings of his son, Hunter Biden, who, by the way, goes to his next trial in September. But if you want to vote in the X poll, you'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find the same question on our website at LarsLarson.com. I've got to call today's Supreme Court decision absolutely bizarre. And here's why. there were six justices who voted in favor of allowing the government to continue using social media companies to do the kind of censorship of free speech that the Constitution specifically forbids the government from doing. And it's notable for a couple of reasons. Number one, the court did not decide this on the merits of the case. They merely said, on the basis that now is not the time to decide this, one of the issues that Turley pointed out in that Fox News interview.
So this issue will have to wait for another day. But one of the things that many of us have been arguing for years is that the government is engaging in censorship by surrogate. I testified about this in Congress, that they have made a mockery of the limits of the First Amendment by doing indirectly what they're barred from doing directly. They're using academic and corporate allies to bar and cancel and blacklist critics on a variety of different subjects.
Yeah, a variety of different subjects, because the government is not allowed to propagandize the American public. The government is not allowed to censor the American public. But what the Biden regime has discovered is that when they go to the social media companies, and the social media companies know that they operate at the behest of the United States government. After all, there are all kinds of regulatory agencies and court decisions and federal agencies. And if you don't keep them happy, then in social media, you just might be out of business. So the high court has taken a side in favor of censorship by the government aimed against the interests of the American public. As the Federalist outlined it, filed by Missouri and Louisiana, the lawsuit before the high court decided today, but not in favor of the people, in favor of the government and government censorship, alleged that the federal government's collusion with big technology companies like Facebook, like Twitter or X, like Google and others, to suppress Americans' online speech violates the First Amendment. That was the decision of the lower courts. Well, shortly after taking power, January of 21, the Biden administration began coordinating with social media giants to censor posts they found unfavorable, even if said posts contained factually correct information. And that's been well established. So what happened? Well, the Federalist says the FBI confirmed as recently as last month it has resumed its efforts in collusion with social media companies to censor posts that it claims are disinformation. I think all of us have our favorite examples over the last 4 years, and especially during the pandemic, of things that were called misinformation that we later found out were absolutely true. And Justice Alito wrote the strong dissent. There were three justices who said no to this. He said for months, high-ranking government officials placed unrelenting pressure on Facebook to suppress Americans' free speech. Because the court unjustifiably refuses to address this serious threat to the First Amendment, I respectfully dissent. And he's right to dissent. They're saying, well, you have to allow the government to use the bully pulpit. If you look up any definition of the bully pulpit, it means, and it was created by Teddy Roosevelt, but if you said, I'm the president, I can give a speech and people will pay attention to it, that is the bully pulpit. It does not say that the bully pulpit says, I can go behind closed doors, I can talk to these companies and say, the American public doesn't need to hear or see this information, please take it down. And those social media companies, I think for both political reasons and financial reasons, said, okay, to whatever the White House told them to do. And they simply said, all right, we will agree to hold that information back from the public. That is censorship of free speech. That is forbidden to the government. And the government isn't allowed to use an agent like a private company to do what the Constitution says they can't. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. The Northwest Nonsense Commentary is next.
The best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
A lot of jokes about the government begin with one worker digging a hole before another worker immediately fills it in. Portland and Multnomah County want to keep their places as the punchlines in that joke. Some of those stories have now gone national about Multnomah County spending literally millions to buy and distribute tens of thousands of tents and tarps to homeless drug addicts. If you listen to this show regularly, we've literally been talking about it since last year. Portlandia, I kid you not, then spends tens of millions of dollars to clean up the very same tents and tarps now contaminated with human waste, drugs, needles, and the rest. If you wonder why any government would behave that way, dollars define the problem. Multnomah County spent, believe it or not, $530 million last year, allegedly serving the needs of about 6,000 so-called homeless people. Now, if you're a numbers guy like me, you'll notice that's about $88,000 per homeless person, and the problem has only become worse. The money ain't really going to the folks you see on the street. It's going to a gigantic homeless industrial complex of government workers and nonprofit groups, some of them with executives pulling down north of $200,000 a year. Those folks want to keep their jobs, and fixing the problem is not going to do that. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give the Daily Grill to whatever's going on at America's Supreme Court, not because of their pro-censorship decision, but get this. The Supreme Court is now 0-2. Two different abortion decisions about a year apart, and both of them accidentally, I put that in quote marks, released early. The Supreme Court just a couple of hours ago said, yes, we accidentally, mistakenly posted an abortion ruling document on the website. Then they tore it down. It had to do with abortions in the case of medical emergencies in Idaho. They accidentally posted it early, kind of like the decision on Dobbs was posted early by somebody else. And all of the investigative agencies of the federal government were unable to find out who, even though the suspect list was very short. Today's best email. You can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Window Nation semi-annual sale. Now on with 50% off all windows, no interest 5 years, bonus savings if you sign up for an evaluation today. Call 866-90-NATION or visit WindowNation.com. Charlie writes in, and it's about a subject we've been talking about, the flags flying off the construction cranes on the University of Oregon campus. Lars, I'll apologize in advance if I'm beating a dead horse, but while walking past that construction site this morning, I saw a man wearing a Ness Campbell t-shirt. So the prominent crane company either rented the cranes to Hoffman, the construction company, or they're supplying the operator. So I did what any good culture war correspondent would do. I asked him if the cranes on this project were those that received the request from U of O to take down the flags. He confirmed, saying that U of O said they had received 150 complaints about what? About flying the American flag on the crane. The worker also confirmed the contractors are under contract to Phil Knight, not to the University of the State of Oregon. Meanwhile, U of O continues to fly the flag and play the national anthem before every sporting event. As you say, if liberals didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all. Signed, Charlie. Now, on that note, I want to bring our friend Aaron Mesh on, the news editor at Willamette Week, a bit early because we're going to try and hit four big subjects in a row. Aaron, welcome back.
I would like to make it clear that I have no standards at all.
You have no that's all right. And I'm sure the American flag does not fly over the offices of Willamette Week, or does it?
I can't afford flags. Those are for people with money.
Okay, fair enough. Let's start with JVP, the short-term acronym for Jessica Vega Peterson of Multnomah County. I was just mentioning the county and its $500 million spent on homeless people, which ordinarily would have made all those homeless people wealthy, but instead it makes nonprofit executives and county employees wealthy. What's her fight with her former to sell her home to some developers, and why she's making her own former neighbors unhappy about that?
Well, it's a very common kind of battle, right? So first, I believe you and I have spoken previously, or if we haven't, I'm sure you've talked about the fact that the chair, Jessica Vega Peterson, or JVP for short, is moving from East Portland out to the West Hills. So she is decamping from the poorer neighborhoods on the east side of the city where she made her bones, and moving to the very nice neighborhoods up above the city.
She's moving on up.
Already,
good.
That already is a bit of an optical problem for her. The optics are poor, as they say in the business. On the other hand, she is trying to sell the two homes that she is departing. One of them is a home she owns, and the other is an investment home, is my understanding. And they're out east of 120th Avenue. And the neighbors on her block are very upset because they've learned that the listing for the properties said that those houses could be turned into a 35 or 33 unit apartment complex or cottage cluster.
JVP lives in a teardown. Is that what you're telling me? Aaron?
Sorry, I'm not trying to give you dead air. I said yes, that is correct.
Okay, so she lives in a teardown. She really is moving up to an actual house you wouldn't tear down. And she wants to leave her neighbors with this brand new massive development right in the middle of their single family neighborhood?
See, here's where I felt that you might go contrarian on me, and I kind of hoped you would.
Okay.
We, in fact, could argue that she is doing what is the best thing and most in alignment with her policy. She is, in fact, offering developers the opportunity to take two housing units and turn them into 35 housing units.
Do you know why I wouldn't go that way? Because she's not moving to a neighborhood of apartment buildings. She's dropping the apartment building on her neighborhood like a bomb as she walks out the door. That's not living up to your policies. It's saying, I want those policies, just not for me.
Right, but no one wants those policies for them. Right? The neighbors don't want them for them. JVP doesn't want them for them. You don't want them for you. But on the other hand, you do spend a lot of time on the radio complaining about the people who sleep outside. So maybe at some point we should, like, build some more apartments.
Well, how about build some more houses? And the best people to decide what kind of houses people want are the folks who sell the houses, the developers who build the houses. If you ask them, do you think most people want to be crammed into an apartment? And you say, well, maybe at the start of their career, but down the line, they probably all want a backyard if they can get one. Well, the county has and the state have decreed, no, you can't have them. They're only for certain people. You need to stay in an apartment. I don't agree with that policy at all. And I don't think if you put it to a public vote, it would be passed by the voters. Do you?
Well, sure. Everyone, I actually agree with you on this point. Way, I think almost everyone, I won't say everyone, but certainly myself and many people would prefer to live in a single family home with a I myself would prefer to live deep in the woods in a cabin, never talk to anyone ever again. However,
like Ted Kaczynski,
most people would enjoy living in a single family home. But we live in a capitalist society.
We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. That's Aaron Mesh. He is the managing editor at Willamette Week. It's a Wednesday. The debate is tomorrow night. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. No need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We brought on my friend Aaron Mesh, the managing editor at Willamette Week. Find the stories at WWeek.com. Before we leave the subject of the chair of the Multnomah County Commission and Jessica Vega Peterson, otherwise known as JVP, and the fact that she's leaving behind her old neighborhood and dropping the bomb by selling her two homes and saying, hey, you could build a 35-unit apartment complex on these and imposing that on the people she used to live next to while she moves off to the high-dollar territory of Portland's West Hills. Aaron, my point is that human beings occupy less than 4% of the landmass of both Oregon and Washington. There is plenty of land to build houses on and build the kind of houses that people would like to live in. Now, if people want to live in rabbit hutches, tiny, tiny little apartments, you know, 300, 400 square foot apartments, I'm sure you can get one of those. I just think that most people would rather not. And yet we're told by our government masters like JVP, you must live in these tiny places while we live as elites in these expensive places that actually have yards and some elbow room. That's my objection.
Are you under the impression that we all make the same amount of money, or that we should all make the same amount of money?
I didn't say we all make the same amount of money, but I will say this. Urban growth boundaries.
This sounds like socialism.
Urban growth boundaries that artificially constrain land due to land in the Northwest, what OPEC did to oil. What De Beers did diamonds. If you artificially limit the supply of anything, the cost goes through the roof. And that's what they've done. They've said, we can't build on that land. We don't have enough land, even though it's taken 170 years for human beings to get to less than 4% of the state. If we expanded at the same rate for the next 150 years, by the time we got into the, to 150 years from now, we'd be at 8% of the state and 92% would still be empty. So why artificially constrain the supply of anything like a place to live?
Because if you could expand the urban growth boundary all the way to Mountain Hood, you still would not be able to put money in people's pockets to afford the single family.
But would you guess what would happen to the single most expensive, it's at least 50% of most people's houses is the cost of the land it sits on. If you could have more land, then that means the cost of the land goes down. And when you do that, you reduce the cost of the house. Correct?
I'm not buying that, in fact, like the developers would still build them.
Sure they would. They still make money. They make money on putting the wires and the plumbing in the ground and putting the 2x6s together the house.
I see what you're saying. I genuinely don't think you're going to be able to like make that much of a difference in the number of you. Well, maybe.
There is a reason they put that UGB up. They said we don't want to serve people who live in houses. We want them crammed into apartment units. But let's move on.
No,
we got three more.
The UGB up is to protect farmland and forests.
Yeah, from
that's
what?
Why we're going
from what? Because right now, Aaron, if you went out and took any piece of farmland anywhere in Oregon and you said, how much can I buy this land from? What can I grow on it? How much money can I make from growing things on it? Even pot, you can't service the mortgage on the land. So when people say we're saving this land for farmland, who's going to farm that land who didn't inherit it from mom and dad? And the answer is, almost nothing you can grow will even pay the cost of the land. So how do you farm something when it's a money-losing operation unless you're either A, already very, very wealthy, B, have a six- or seven-figure income, or you've won the lottery? There's no way to do it.
All right. Genuinely think the main reason why you're making this argument is you just don't like apartment buildings, which are useful to
No,
people.
I used to live in apartment buildings. I'm just saying that people should have the choice to live where they want to live, not where Jessica Vega Peterson determines that we shall all live while she gets the luxury of living in a single family house. I think that's hypocritical. And I want everybody to have the choice I had, and she should want everybody to have the choice she had. But it sounds like she's imposing a different kind of choice, saying you will live in an apartment because we aren't going to make very many single family houses. And so the ones that are out there being limited in supply are going to do what? They're going to go up like a skyrocket.
But I guess I'm just not tracking your argument, because it seems to me like you're arguing that what JVP should do, although she doesn't control it, is she should advocate for changing the urban growth boundary so that she can live in the West Hills and that everyone else gets a single family home.
Who wants one?
I genuinely don't think the outcome that you think is going to happen is in fact.
You may be entirely right about that. I want to cover these three other stories, though. One. The catalytic converter kingpin, this is the guy who was, tens of thousands of catalytic converters, and he ended up being the fence for this whole thing?
That's right. We have the accused catalytic converter kingpin of Lake Oswego, Brennan Doyle, whose trial is set for October, but this week a new bevy of documents dropped in which police detectives lay out their theory of the workings of the ring, how they got the catalytic converter from underneath your car into a warehouse in Clackamas County, where Brennan Doyle then fenced it to guys in Kansas City. It's a really interesting story. And in case you were wondering, well, where are all the homeless guys who are addicted to blues in this story? Oh, don't worry. They're there, too. Brennan Doyle was working with them very closely.
Okay, the other issue is this. My granddaughter and I have gone to Oaks Park, not recently, but we plan to go back. And then all of a sudden we saw that one of their rides, as you said, became a janky carnival ride and got stuck with people upside down for a half an hour. Scary. Everybody made it out alive, although perhaps terrorized by what had happened. What's going on there?
Well, it's really interesting. Yesterday around 5 p.m., we got a hold of documents in which attorneys who were considering a lawsuit against the park say that they've received information, and we were able to confirm that information, that that people who rode that ride a week prior to the ride's breakdown experienced malfunctions as well, or so they claim. It raises questions about just how safe this ride that both the park and people say is safe is actually safe.
So if they were on notice that their ride was having problems and they didn't address them in some way, that makes the liability even bigger, doesn't it?
If true, it would. I'm being a little careful because I don't want to actually, like, you know, end up testifying in a court case about...
You're breaking up a little bit on me, so get near a window or put some tinfoil on your head. Let me ask you about the Multnomah County judges. It seems that having had the reform of Measure 110, so-called, that really wasn't much of a reform, they said, now you can threaten these people with jail. And then it seemed to me that Multnomah County did everything it could to say, so we've designed a system that is guaranteed to make meth dealers and meth users not see jail. What's the bottom line?
So here, I think it's really important to differentiate a few things in context. I'm going to focus on one narrow part of this story. There is a larger question about how the post-Measure 110 or reformed Measure 110 world is going to work, what's known as deflection. And I'm sure you'll talk about that. That's not actually my subject. My subject is this. When voters decided to decriminalize the possession of hard drugs, they did not decriminalize the sale of hard drugs. It was still illegal to sell hard drugs. And yet, that was a distinction without a difference on the streets of Portland. Why was it a distinction without a difference on the streets of Portland? It was because as soon as you were arrested by a police officer for selling drugs, you would be sent through a revolving door in the jail system and be out on the same street corner the same day. We reported on that last summer. It was because of rules that the Multnomah County judges had set up for what's known as pretrial hearings. So these defendants, these people who were dealing drugs, never saw a judge. They went right back on the street the same day. Thanks to our reporting, that's no longer the case. They now have to see a judge who will set bail, and if the judge has any stones at all, that judge will in fact set bail so high they can't get out.
I sure hope you are right about that. That's Aaron Mesh, the editor at Willamette Week. You can find his stories and others at WWeek.com. Coming up in just a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. We'll talk more about that crazy question, the Supreme Court authorizing owning investment.
You have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Tomorrow night, the big debate, Joe Biden, if he shows up, and Donald Trump, who I think will mop the floor with the current president of the United States. Our X poll today, will the candidate's performance tomorrow night make any difference in your vote for president? I would say no, and so far the voting seems to be overwhelmingly no, it's not going to make any difference at all. Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show on X, also on our website at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go first to Ron. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
The Supreme Court decision, Lars, because the point is this.
Yeah.
As you know, I used to post stuff in 2020 that you bring truth. I was censored on my Facebook page. I was censored on the frontline doctors. I was censored because I didn't comply with the Black Lives Matter mantra with the Antifa and George Floyd. I'm an American, but to allow to say that we don't have standing, to say that I got to watch my feed of 1,400 friends be whittled down to nothing, like what they've done to others, like yourself and others that may be on Facebook or other media or censor your searches and say that Ms. Griffin Velotti would be a misinformation, our girdles of this time period for the state of Oregon, that's acceptable? It's very troubling, Lars.
Yes, it's not just troubling, but when they say there will be somebody both withstanding and bringing it at the right time and place and manner and all that, all they're saying is the government will be censoring and will be leaning on those social media companies over the next less than 5 months until an election. I can't imagine that there will be a more consequential time for America to make a decision. And if you deny Americans the ability to know what's going on and that they simply have to take whatever they see on social media as the God's honest truth, I don't think it's ever smart to depend on just one source of information. But what are people supposed to do when we already know that the government will lie, and Joe Biden's government has lied about things like the laptop from hell, that we now know there were people who were current government contractors who signed that letter, that fraudulent letter saying it's all Russian disinformation. Except now we know for a fact it was Hunter Biden's laptop. It did implicate Joe Biden. It would have been terribly significant, except that story was shut down. And it also worked against Americans and their best interests during the pandemic and 100 other ways. Now imagine what they will do with the right to censor between now and November.
Lars, well, basically what they're basically saying, because I'm an American, you know how I am. I don't care about color. But if I don't walk the line, this is basically, I'm going to call it the new term, from Wilsonian to the present, Jim Crow policies. This is not Jim Crow, Jim Crow. This affects freedom of speech. Anybody that doesn't walk the way they want, because you're not liberal enough, you're not black enough, you're walking off your plantation, you're not Native American enough, because you're going against and speaking against what they think is truth when you bring out the truth in front of anybody. Or you're a doctor, we're going to censor you because you brought up medication for hydrochloroquine for 324 million
like
people.
Like Dr. Malone, yeah. Dr. Bhattacharya, all those guys. And Ron, if the legacy media had any stones, they would go right to Joe Biden and his surrogates and say, will you commit to order your federal agencies not to engage in leaning on social media to shape the message narrative that's going out to Americans, not to say hold things back? And they have the gall to say this is all about the government using the bully pulpit. Well, Ron, that bully pulpit terminology has a meaning. If you're the president or a governor or a mayor or somebody impressed, somebody who's a celebrity of one kind or another, you can step up to a mic and offer any message you want. What it doesn't give, what the bully pulpit does not mean, is you have the ability to go behind the scenes and simply limit what the American public hears from anybody else. That is not using the bully pulpit. Let's go to Phyllis. Hey, Phyllis, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
No, I just got contacted by the city that I live in that is saying I have to take down my Trump display on my house.
Why?
They said that they got a complaint on it. One of the neighbors.
So what? You have free speech rights. It's your property, right?
Exactly. It's not on public property. It is displayed on the second story of the wall of my house facing the street. They also told me that I had to take down my Trump flag. The lady that showed up asked us about the star flag. She didn't even know what it was. It's an Israel flag. We've got a U.S. flag and we've got a Trump flag, and we have to take the Trump flag down. She said the Israel flag is okay.
You know, Phyllis, I'll tell you what, if you stick around, I'll have my producer get your contact info. I'm going to ask my producer to put you in touch with a couple of different organizations like First Liberty that may go to bat for you. And if they think your situation is right, because you got to be right on the rules, but if the city or the county is telling you you have to take down something that amounts to free speech on your property, I think you may have a case. And in that case, just tell the city to pound sand. Which city is it, by the way?
Right. It is Dallas, Oregon.
Dallas, Oregon. So Dallas, Oregon is getting into the...
I'm at work, and my mom took the information, my elderly mother, and she got a business card from them. But they produced no ordinance of any kind stating that there was a city ordinance against this stuff.
I'll tell you what, stay on the line for a second. Let us get your contact info and see if one of those legal firms is willing to go to bat for you. This segment brought to you by 540training.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
It would have been so
in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's one day before the first presidential debate, which I think is going to be a Donnybrook for Joe Biden, but we'll see. We'll see how that goes. I don't think he's going to do all that very well. But glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And it's great to welcome back with a brand new title, Herman Bertschinger, who is chair of the Josephine County Commissioners. How are you doing, Commissioner?
I'm doing great, Lars. I'm going to step inside my truck here to cut down on some of this noise, okay?
No, you've always got noise. You're probably out on a logging site somewhere, aren't you?
No. No, I'm actually I'm in town, and I just got out of a meeting. So, but we're good now.
And by in town, which town are we talking about in this case?
We are in Grants Pass, Oregon, beautiful Southern Oregon.
Well, hey, the Supreme Court hasn't come down with a Grants Pass decision yet, have they?
You know, isn't that amazing? Grants Pass is at the tip of the spear of this homeless stuff.
Yep.
Isn't that crazy? I think it's crazy.
It's great, though. I think you're going to win. I think they're going to say, of course, a community has the ability to tell people you can't just park in or camp indefinitely on public property that you don't own. You don't get any special rights that other citizens don't have, do you?
That's true. You know, and you know, the whole homeless question, you know, we're dealing with a group of people that just, I say they don't really want to participate in our society. So, you know,
but they want all the benefits of living in our society. They want the freebies and the giveaways. They want to know that if I get sick, all I have to do is walk into a hospital or a clinic and say I need care and they have to give it to me, and that I'll be looked at very sympathetically by the rest of the population. So you get all the benefits of living in a society without actually having to participate in that society. Does that sound equitable
well,
to you?
Well, that's right. And then look at all the nonprofits that are just making all kinds of money off of it. So,
well, believe me, Multnomah County spending north of $500 million last year. And when you look up some of the executives that are running these homeless agencies, they're making over $200,000 a year and a PERS pension on top of that.
it blows your mind. The last time I looked, and little old Grants Pass, you know, we're only about 37,000 people, but there was 85 or 83 different places they can go for free services. Is that amazing?
It is, and by the time you've offered them all that, if they're not willing to take it, then you say, then you have to go somewhere else. We don't care where you go. You've been offered help. You've turned the help down, and now you need to go. I want to ask you about something else, though, that actually affects real, working, tax-paying, law-abiding citizens, and that is the wildfire maps put together by the state of Oregon. And there's a lot of concern about that, about what it's going to do to people who live in rural areas like Josephine County. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, first of all, yes, I definitely do. And as you probably know, you alluded to, that's kind of my wheelhouse. It was when I was in the Senate for 8 years. You know, I was on all the wildfire committees, on the task force for the governor and all that stuff. So, you know, I understand it. But I was so disappointed in Oregon Department of Forestry. They put a town hall meeting on down here in Josephine County. They spoke for about 10 minutes, and then they said, okay, now we're going to bust up into groups, and you're going to go to all these different stations. This, you know, the federal government, the Forest Service and BLM started this years ago, and now ODF is doing it. It's no longer a town hall meeting. Nobody knows what the narrative is. Nobody knows what the conversation is. There's no questions being asked. And, you know, that's what's good about a town hall. You get all these people. There was a couple hundred people there. You get people in a room. One person asks a question. That spurs other questions from other people. But when you divide them up and say, oh, go to our stations, nobody knows what the conversation is anymore.
So it's engineered to make sure you don't get people who hear a question, like you said, and say, wow. You know, some farmer says, hey, if you do this to us, this is going to have this effect on me and my business. And other people who may be farmers or maybe not farmers say, oh, I never thought of it that way. Well, yeah, it would have an adverse effect. And that causes me to want to ask this question. And all of that is thrown away when you deliberately engineer around having an actual town hall.
That's right. But then they'll go and they'll say, oh, we did town halls all across the state. And the consensus is, so that's how it all works. But, Lars, let's back up a little bit. You know, one thing I learned in the Senate when I was up there is there's always an agenda. So you got to go to the 30,000 foot view and look at the agenda. What is the agenda in Oregon? The environmental community has been trying to depopulate rural Oregon since Senate Bill 100,
yep.
If you think about it.
Yep.
And that's the number one. So there's the number one thing. Number two, the legislature has been trying to get the general fund out of large fire costs as long as I can remember. So right now there's three buckets of money that pays for large fires. One is the large landowners pay some. Two is an insurance policy from Lloyd's of London, which a general fund pays for. And then three, it's just the general fund. They would love to get the general fund out of paying for fire so they can go spend it on all their little projects. And then they're going to, so this is how it's going to work. We're going to get this map done. We're going to identify all these places in Oregon that you're living in the WUI, the wildland fire environment. And now we're going to tax you for living there to pay for the fire costs.
So that's in other words, you're going to use an economic lever to pry people yep. loose from rural parts of the state and force them to go elsewhere.
Right. And if you think the legislature, if you think the Democrats are worried about you not being able to get fire insurance or can't afford it or it goes up, they could care less. That's just that, hey, let's make it as expensive and as hard to live in rural Oregon as we can. Let's do that because that meets our objective to depopulate rural Oregon.
Which means, correct me if I'm wrong, that having big fires, which we don't have to have with proper forest management, and we saw what that did from about 53 to 88, there were no big fires. None. Not one. Now we average a 500,000 acres a year. So those big fires serve the agenda because you can use the fires as an excuse to say we got to keep people away from all this land they own. Right?
Well, can we all not forget what Mr. Axelrod said when he said, don't ever let a crisis go to waste?
Yep.
So, listen, Lars, as long as you have forests, you have forest fires. You can go back thousands of years. As long as there's forest fires. 1910 come along, bad, horrible fire year. And the public come out and said, hey, we want these put out. Forest Service was established. Pinshaw was the first Forest Service chief. Then yep. they come into the policy out by 10. That means if there's a fire starts in a forest, we want to try to get it out by 10 the next day. That worked great, okay, as long as you're managing the forest. But as soon as you don't manage the forest and you still have an out by 10 policy, the fuel loading grows so you know, the fuel loading continues to grow on these acres. And then when you do have a fire, it's a big fire.
Exactly. That's Herman Bertschinger, former Oregon State Senator, now Josephine County Commission Chair. Now you...
actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, the Biden regime is going to try a brand new approach when it comes to guns. You see, Joe Biden and his friends would like to have guns for themselves and all the people who protect them. They just don't want American citizens to have any guns. The problem is that for the most part, they have been unable to get the Congress to do anything to add more laws to the roughly 20,000 laws that currently exist that limit the Second Amendment rights of Americans. So what have they decided to do instead? They've asked the U.S. Surgeon General to do it for them and to do it without benefit of changing the law or seeking out any kind of vote by your representatives in the House of Representatives or in the U.S. Senate. In other words, if the Senate doesn't have to act and the House doesn't have to act and the president doesn't have to sign his name to a bill, it makes it a lot easier. So U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy formally declared a gun violence public health crisis as of yesterday. He called for a ban on so-called assault weapons, a terminology that doesn't actually mean anything, and on civilian use of so-called large capacity magazines, even though finding out what the actual definition of that is a bit problematic. So what are they going to do instead? They are going to do something that is unconstitutional. In other words, if they declare it a public health crisis, then they don't have to ask for votes in the House. They don't have to ask for votes in the Senate. They just have to say it's a public health crisis. We can pretty much do what we want. It is a constitutional workaround that is thoroughly unconstitutional. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with my point of view on whatever it is we're talking about, we're glad to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So the Surgeon General Murthy announces yesterday he's going to declare a public health crisis. Now, what does that mean? I think for the most part, it means just about anything that Dr. Vivek Murthy wants it to mean. Medical organizations have already lined up the usual suspects, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Public Health Association, the American College of Students, of Surgeons, I should say, and even the YWCA. I don't know how they got on the list, but he formally declared the gun violence public health crisis as of yesterday. He said firearms violence is an urgent public health crisis that has led to the loss of life, unimaginable pain, and profound grief for far too many Americans. Well, firearms violence? You mean violence by people who are armed with a gun. Now, would it be any different if they were armed with a knife? And we've seen some horrific knife attacks, or with an SUV, and we've seen those kinds of attacks as well. What they want to do is blame the gun. Now, is the gun doing the deed? No, the person behind the gun is doing the deed. And yet Vivek Murthy seems to think that if he can do it this way, he can get something done that even Joe Biden was not able to accomplish, because Joe Biden hasn't been able to move anything on Capitol Hill. He hasn't been able to get any new laws passed. Thank goodness. I'm glad to see that he has not been able to do that. But that is the way that the founders of this country intended that we change public laws. That to change a public law, you've got to actually go to the people's representatives and say, we'd like you to outlaw this. And then the representatives either say yes or no. Fact is, for the most part, the representatives have said no. Conservatives on Capitol Hill, and there are far too few of those these days, they've said no because they don't believe that we need more gun laws. What we need is more laws that lock people up so that they can't commit the crimes. Simply taking away the guns is not going to solve the problem. Okay? So the liberals, on the other hand, Democrats, most of them, have said, I don't want to vote for that law. If I vote for that law, I'm going to lose my seat in the United States Congress because I have a lot of constituents at home that may be registered Democrats. But the fact is, they're not going to go for this limitation because they understand that it's not the guns that are causing the problem. It is the violent people. And of course, the liberal Democrats also are almost required by their Democratic Party membership to say this isn't about bad people doing bad things. And in fact, it is exactly that. It is absolutely the only thing that's actually causing the problem. So Vivek Murthy is saying, well, we're going to create this. We're going to create this public health crisis. And that means that we will, under the cover of a public health crisis, the same way we saw that under the cover of a public health crisis 4 years ago because of a pandemic that turned out to be a whole lot different than we were told, that they were able to do just about anything they wanted. They could shut down businesses. They could limit the free movement of American citizens. In the state of California, for example, the governor of that state, while going out to dinner with his buddies at high-dollar restaurants, was able to tell the rest of the people in his state, you're not allowed to leave your house. You're not allowed to go to church. You're not allowed to sing in a choir. You're not allowed to do just about anything. And if a lot of you, as I did at the time, thought, you know, this could be a test case for what they can do with that kind of authority, given whether Americans will actually follow the orders that are given to them. And that's exactly what happened. You saw a lot of states that refused to go with the program, and they ended up just about the same result in terms of deaths or illness or infection as the states that went into full-blown lockdown, like the state of California. But what's on Murthy's list right now? He wants a ban on carrying firearms. And this shows such, you know, if he wants to treat this like a public health crisis, I've been pointing out for a long, long time that the most dangerous place you can be in America if you're worried about a mass shooting incident is in a gun-free zone. Mass shooting incidents, about 94% of those incidents happen in so-called gun-free zones. And think about this for just a moment. If you look at the entire map of America, how much of it is a gun-free zone? And the answer is very little of it. I mean, there are certain buildings that are off-limits. In some states, they have made schools off-limits to guns. But the percentage of the entire landscape that's gun-free zones is very, very small. And yet the percentage of the mass shooting incidents that happen in those gun-free zones is very, very large. So what does Vivek Murthy want to do? He wants to make more gun-free zones in America by forbidding the carry of guns everywhere he can get. He wants a ban on so-called assault weapons. There is no effective definition of what an assault weapon is, nor what it isn't. You can be assaulted by a person who's carrying a gun, whether the gun is a .22 caliber single-shot single-shot pistol, or whether or not it's a semi-automatic, a gun that shoots 7.62 or 5.53 rounds. It doesn't matter. The fact is, you can be assaulted with any of those things. Let me go to Leanne. Hey, Leanne, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. We're close to the break. What do you think of Surgeon General Murthy's idea?
I think that there's a people problem, not a gun problem.
Agreed.
Guns don't shoot themselves.
Nope.
And I am a gun violence victim. I was shot. I almost died. I spent a year inside a hospital fighting for my life because it's the gunshot or the bullet went through my stomach and placed the dead. And I did that for a year trying to recover and with my stomach wide open.
I certainly hope that you're recovering well. Leanne, thank you very much.
The Lars Larson Show. Broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours, it's Sanitized Entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday and anticipating tomorrow night's presidential debate. That should be interesting. I thought we'd talk with my friend Dr. John Lott. He is an economist. He's the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of a lot of great books on the Second Amendment, including, I think most notably for me, More Guns, Less Crime. Dr. Lott, welcome back, and I want to tell you that I've already told my audience what my point of view is on Surgeon General Murthy's idea of a public health crisis, but I want you to tell them what you know, because you know the numbers better than just about anybody in America when it comes to shootings, hazards, assaults, and the lawful use of firearms. What should we make of the Surgeon General's announcement yesterday?
Well, I think there are two general points. One is, kind of the numbers that he puts out are misleading. But I think there's a more important point, and that is, what do we do to solve any type of crimes that we have occurring with guns, which are overwhelmingly involving things like gang fights. That's where most of these murders are occurring, and that's making up the vast majority of the numbers that they have there. And, you know, you read his 39-page report, there's not any mentions of prosecutions or punishment or jails. There's one mention of police in the entire thing, and that was just with regard to police shooting people, not with regard to police arresting criminals. You know, his whole thing is basically we need to get rid of people owning guns and have all sorts of restrictions on it. And so, you know, I could go through, and you may have already talked about the problems with his numbers, because, you know, guns are not the leading cause of death. But it's even more important to me.
No, let's go through them, John. I want people to be armed with information. So when people say to them, but guns are the leading cause of death, let's go right through them. I've only mentioned the prevalence of mass shootings in gun-free zones. But explain to them why Surgeon General Murthy, who says he's going to use an evidence-based approach to this, is actually twisting the evidence.
Right. Well, so he'll say children and adolescents. Adolescents, at least by my definition, if you look it up in the dictionary, basically it says people who are not, you know, the age of majority, who are not adults. You know, basically in the United States, people become adults at age 18. There are two states, Alabama and Nebraska, where you technically become an adult at age 19. But there's no states that have it so that up through 19 years of age, you're still classified as not being an adult. And so, you know, if you look at under 18 or you look at under 19, no matter how you want to cut it, motor vehicle deaths are greater than for firearms deaths. But there, and if you look at it for up to 20, basically it's very close. But the problem there is how they count the numbers even then. And the issue is what they want to do is count homicides, suicides, and accidental deaths. Homicides involve two types of numbers. They involve murders plus justifiable homicides by police and by civilians. Right. And it's never really been obvious to me why you want to mix those two things together. If a police officer has to shoot a criminal who's threatening the officer or somebody else, or if a woman goes and shoots a serial rapist who breaks into her home at 2 a.m. in the morning, those are very different than, let's say, a robber going in fatally shooting his victim that's there. Or you have two gangs that are fighting against each other over drug trade. And if you go and look at murders plus suicides plus accidental deaths, those numbers are clearly significantly less than vehicle deaths that are there. And so, you know, those are just two of the changes that they make there. You either go and deal with the age, or you deal with murders rather than homicides. Either one of those, let alone both of those changes together, would make it so that the claim is false.
And what do you think he has in mind when he says we want to have a ban on so-called assault weapons? I know what he's using the term of art to indicate. He's talking about semi-automatic rifles. But if he wants a ban on all of those, he's talking about the most popular guns that Americans legally and lawfully own and use, and he wants them banned. And the Congress hasn't been able to do it, and I don't think they should, but Joe Biden, if he wants a change in the law, should go to the Congress and ask for it. And clearly he knows he's going to get a no, probably even from the U.S. Senate.
Right. Well, look. You know, if you believe Biden, maybe he means what Biden means. Biden many times has talked about banning all semi-automatic guns, both handguns and rifles. But, you know, the vast majority of guns, about 85% of the guns in the United States, are semi-automatic guns. But if even if you go and want to say, let's ban semi-automatic rifles, what's the alternative? You know, guns that you have to manually reload yourself. Civilians benefit from having semi-automatic guns when they're using it in self-defense. If you have to fire more than once because, let's say, you fire and miss, or you're facing multiple attackers, or you fire and wound but don't incapacitate the attacker, you may not have the luxury of time to go and manually reload your gun there at that point. And so, you read through Murphy's discussion there, and it's basically all he lists are costs from guns. There's no discussion about trade-offs. There's no discussion about the benefits that are there. And it reminds me very much of the public health discussions with regard to COVID, where, you know, they were basically saying, if we could save one life by making it so that people can't spread the disease, then it's worthwhile having these restrictions. There's no discussion about what the costs are of closing down the schools so that people can't learn. There's no discussion about suicides that might occur when people are locked up in their homes. There's no discussions about the health consequences of making it so that people can't go in and get medical care. You know, so you had a lot of people who may have had cancer who weren't getting treatment, or whose diseases were discovered much later than they would have been otherwise and reached a critical stage where they couldn't help them. And so, you know, the problem with public health people generally is that they don't understand the notion of trade-offs. It's not just the cost that you have to look at here. You have to look at the net benefits and costs to see whether an action on net saves or costs lives.
Well, in fact, John, you'd think that'd be the one thing that people in medicine would understand the best. They'd say, we're going to give you this medicine. It has a 75% chance of curing what ails you. It also has these other downsides. It might wipe out your liver. Most of the really good drugs do wipe out your liver. Or it might, you know, might cause other problems for you. But the net result is better, even if there's only a 75% chance of actually curing you. They do those kinds of things all the time. They'll do surgery on somebody and say, well, there's a chance you could get an infection from this surgery and die.
Right.
But there's a much greater chance that it's going to take out your appendix and it's going to take care of your problem 100%. And they always do those trade-offs until it comes to public health. That's Dr. John Lott from the Crime Prevention Research Center. I serve on the board of the center, uncompensated, by the way. He's the author most recently of More Guns, Less Crime. And we've got this crazy idea. The U.S. Surgeon General, because the Congress won't act on guns and can't because the people told them not to, the Surgeon General is going to take control all by himself. And you've got the Lars Larson Show. Are you?
Because you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, which celebrates this year 25 years of serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk. If you want to join the conversation, it's easy to do. That's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. To sell your home immediately, no showings, no hassles. You pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Let me cite a column by the alleged conservative at the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper. That's Danny Westney. But he says, down in the 3rd Congressional District of Southwest Washington, the first-term incumbent, that's the very left-wing, almost communist, Marie Glusenkamp Perez, a Democrat from Skamania, whose husband and she have a business in Portland, which means their feet are on both sides of the river. But she just rolled out a brand new ad. Now, remember, she's a far left Democrat, but the ad is called Keep Us Safe. And he quotes the ad, Marie Perez is taking on the Biden administration. working with Republicans to secure the southern border and improve public safety. I approve this message, and I will do whatever it takes to secure the border and keep Southwest Washington safe. That's a bit of a change of tune from Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez, who's been voting with Joe Biden all the way along, except now she's apparently decided that lack of public safety and a wide open border is not going to do it for her with voters. Just remember, she votes with Biden. She may be talking the right talk right now, but that's just to grab your votes. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let's go to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks. Recently, you were talking about University of Oregon and the construction company flying U.S. flag. Yep. So I took it upon myself to go ahead and try to order public records, any emails, anything like that regarding that. They just responded and say that they have no records regarding that issue at all.
When you say they, you mean the University of Oregon itself?
The University of Oregon, the person in charge of researching all the public records, they say they don't have anything regarding that.
That's interesting, because I got an email from a gentleman this morning who walked past the construction site at University of Oregon campus in Eugene, and he asked one of the people wearing a Nest Campbell's a big crane company, and they either are supplying the cranes or the operators to Hoffman, which is the construction company. And he says, he asked them, did you get a request from U of O to take down the flags? He said, yeah, and the U of O said they had received about 150 complaints. And the worker also confirmed that the contractors are under contract to Phil Knight, not to the University of the State of Oregon. Even though it's being built on the campus, I think Knight is funding this stuff because he's funded a lot of things at the University of Oregon. So I wonder if they're using the dodge of saying, well, it's not us getting the complaints. It's the private company building the building on the university campus. But I'm not sure I'd entirely believe them. But if they tell you they haven't received a single complaint, and yet there are others who say they've had 150 complaints, believe it or not, about the American flag, you know, which one should we believe?
Exactly. I agree with that. And I have a hard time with trusting some of these public agencies and releasing the records.
Just remember that those universities are owned lock, stock, and barrel by the taxpayers. They are funded to a large extent by tuition money borrowed from by students, mostly from the federal government. They're funded by federal grants that come in large quantities, and they're funded by state taxes. They are very much public entities, and it's good to remember that. Thanks very much, Chris. I appreciate it. Let's go to Brian. Hey, Brian, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I got a few things. Fact, you're right on about lack of prosecution and jail time for the offenders. But I've got a
criminals
lame brain. I
hate the term offender. Offender is somebody who, I guess, breaks wind in public. A criminal is something entirely different.
Yes, you're correct. But I'm being political, you know, and that's not right. Anyhow, the thing that I was thinking about the school shootings was, how do these kids get these guns that you and I have?
They steal them, or they get them from, they buy them from somebody who stole them, for the most part. That's the source.
Yeah, well, they supposedly, the one in Texas, he had guns.
Yeah, he bought those legally.
Purchased.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, and how did he afford that when he had nothing?
I can't remember if the timing fit with the stimulus checks or if he just saved up the money. But, Brian, if you're just asking the question, discussing that solve the problem?
It doesn't. I think that the guns are supplied by anti-gunners.
Could be, although Brian, if there was another source of those guns for Uvalde, Texas, there was never anything that indicated that guy was supplied with guns by somebody else to create the problem. I guess it's possible, but it would mean they did the entire investigation of the shooting and found out where he bought it and went to the store where he bought it, but it was actually supplied to him by somebody else. If there was evidence of that, I would think that it'd be public by now, because every reporter in Texas and a lot of reporters nationwide were trying to find out, where did the guy get the guns? By all accounts, he saved his money, he banked it, and he went down and bought the guns himself. And what would have stopped that? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Brian, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls. And don't forget, tomorrow night, it's going to be the big presidential debate. We'll be talking about it a lot in advance of the debate because it happens in the evening. And then we'll talk about it at length on First Amendment Friday. Now, consider this. Should the state of Washington or any state out there charge a per package delivery fee on deliveries as just one more cash grab, in this case by the folks in Olympia at the state legislature? I thought we'd talk about that with Mark Harmsworth, who's director of the Small Business Center for Washington Policy. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back on, Lars. I appreciate
it. Just so I don't screw my audience up, exactly what is it they're proposing to do, and how big is this fee going to be, and why are they talking about imposing this fee on deliveries?
Well, the why I'll answer first is because they're just crazy and they don't understand how business works. But what's happening here is the Washington State Joint Transportation Committee, as part of the budget that was passed in 2023, the transportation budget in Washington State, funded a study by a consultant to look at adding a delivery fee for every package and parcel delivered by folks like Amazon and all your other favorite online stores. And they asked them to consider the fee from 25 cents a delivery to 75 cents a delivery under the idea that they would collect this money and then use it to fix the potholes in our state and the terrible condition of our roads. And this is despite the current majority party taking money that should have been spent fixing potholes to fix the potholes and spending on other things. Now they want even more money.
Well, and in fact, they're collecting all these excess taxes. So if I count them up, you've got the person who's doing the delivery in a vehicle is doing it in a vehicle which has registration fees. That's one form of tax. They've got taxes or excise taxes to the feds on their tires. They've got another tax that applies as a straight gasoline or diesel tax. But then they have the carbon tax that goes in addition to all the gasoline or diesel taxes. They have all that already, and now they say, but we need more.
Yeah, and don't forget, if you're the purchaser, you're paying income taxes, you're paying the sales taxes, you're paying all these other bits and pieces, and often that will add up. And we did a study at the Policy Center. You know, sometimes 50% of what you make, it goes in taxes for you to go and purchase a product. Now they, like you're saying, want even more under the concept that they're going to fix the roads. But arguably, you could say that these trucks are reducing the number of trips because the delivery trucks may do 60 deliveries in an afternoon. That's 60 trips that you'd have done going to the store. They'd put even more wear and tear on the roads.
So, yeah, maybe there should be a credit back the other way, saying you're helping save our roads by keeping people off the roads.
Right. And the other states that have introduced this, Colorado, Minnesota, and I think Minnesota's actually went into effect just a few days ago. But Colorado, the lawmakers there have had such a public backlash against them based on what they did that they're now reconsidering that fee. And plus, in Colorado, once they created the fee, they just started increasing it again. You know, they only did 1 cent the first time, but this would enable the bureaucracy to start increasing fees. And so on, the city of Seattle, as you may know, added a $5 delivery fee, and that caused a 30% drop in Uber Eats and the food delivery services almost overnight, which was devastating to those restaurants that depend on that revenue. And it's like the folks in power just don't connect that the margins on these things are so small, and when they tack these fees on, it can destroy an industry.
Well, and in fact, I saw numbers as high as 45% drop in food deliveries, but whether it's 30 or 45, the city of Seattle at least argued, they said, we're going to put this extra $5 fee for delivering food. And we're going to help the people who are in the business of delivering the food by giving them an extra $5. And then they scare away a third of their customers. And it ends up, they probably end up making less money, or maybe the same amount of money. But it doesn't sound like it helped the food delivery people at all.
No, it didn't. And in this particular fee, what you're going to see, I mean, if you have Prime with Amazon where you're getting free shipping right now, Amazon's now faced with paying this fee on every product it ships. Does it now increase prices of the products? Does it tack the fee on so you really don't get free shipping anymore? I mean, it's not a good idea. You know, Senator Marco Elias was the chair of that committee, and he was pushing this, saying that it was going to fix the roads. I just don't think that's accurate. Well, if we were to focus on our transit dollars on fixing the roads, we'd have plenty of money.
Well, and in fact, let me ask you this. When they say 25 cents to 75 cents per delivery, does that mean, and for instance, I ordered dog treats from Amazon, so I get them every month. I may get four or five little packages in a box. Does that count as four or five deliveries, or does it count as one? I mean, does it matter?
Yeah, I believe that counts as one. I mean, the actual implementation of this will be worked out, obviously. But at 30 cents, which is what the consultant was talking about, it generated an additional $112 million per year for the state of Washington in revenue, which goes straight in the general fund. It's not tagged for transportation specifically and could be used for anything.
Well, in fact, I don't remember. The state of Oregon has a biennial budget for ODOT. Of, I think it's $6 billion every 2 years, so it's $3 billion a year. How big is the budget for WashDOT? You know, and we're going to add $112 million bucks. It sounds like kind of a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, the budget number they're trying to hit, the backlog for the roads, the latest number I'd heard was $7 billion, and they're talking about $1 billion per year. So this is about 10%, which is over 10% of what they need per year to get to where they need to go, just to keep things status quo, is fixing potholes and keeping the streets straight. But they've got a huge backlog. They've spent money on stuff they shouldn't have done.
Think about this, Mark. I just looked it up because I didn't have it parked in my head like I do a lot of these other numbers. The Washington legislature says the biennial budget, so for 2 years, it's $13.5 billion for 2 years. That means it's over $6 billion a year, and we're going to add $112 million, and that's going to fix the problem. Why don't they, and I've got a suggestion for the $6 billion. Would you be willing to bet that most of that WashDOT budget is paid in salaries? Thousands of people who work for WashDOT, and I'd ask, how many of them are actually out there doing anything about the problem, and how many of them are, you know, paper pushers and engineers and the rest? Because $6 billion a year, and you're going to add $112 million, and that's going to suddenly fix the problem you couldn't fix with $6 billion?
Yeah, it's not going to, I mean, it obviously takes a little bite out of it. It's not going to fix the issue. But we're also not considering the huge spend that we're putting into transit, which isn't part of that $13 billion. That's completely separate. So when you start putting all these things together, you're talking billions of dollars. I mean, Sound Transit's already over by $50 billion on its Sound Transit 3 package, which is almost three times as much as what it went to the voters with. It's at $148 billion, the last number I saw. And just the waste that's going on, and for them to come back and ask for more money is ridiculous.
Absolutely right. That's Mark Harmon. He's with the Small Business Center at Washington Policy. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your calls. Coming up in a moment, is government really telling Americans to set their air conditioning to 85 in the summer? I'll give you the straight lowdown on that coming up next.
Talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to tell you in a bit, after I've taken some calls, about what the government is trying to do as we head into summertime. Now, as you know, last week, an awful lot of the United States sat under a heat dome. And would you believe it that there are government agencies out there that are saying, you know, you'd help the rest of us out, you'd probably cut your air conditioning bill if you just set your thermostat to 85 in the summertime. And in the wintertime, set it to be very, very cold. Now, there are people who are suggesting, oh, no, they didn't exactly say that. Well, it turns out they did exactly say that. Now, they did it in kind of a roundabout way. A photo of a television broadcast that showed the thermostat recommendations from Energy Star, which is a program run by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the U.S. Department of Energy. According to the graphic, Energy Star recommends setting your thermostat to 78 degrees when you are at home, 85 degrees when you are not at home, and 82 degrees when you are sleeping. Now, there may be some people who find sleeping at 82 degrees comfortable. I would not be counted in that category. And as for setting your home to 85 degrees, so let's say you work a job, not like a talk show host job, but where you're actually out working in the weather, and it's been hot all day, and you look forward to getting home, and you walk in your front door, and it's 85 degrees. But you know that if you follow the government's recommendations, you can turn that thermostat all the way down to 78. No, I don't think most Americans are going to go for that. And yet that is exactly what the EPA is pushing, saying, oh, it'll save you some money. And they are probably right. It would lower your electric bill. On the other hand, you didn't buy the air conditioning to live in a kind of cooled off home. I would imagine that most of you bought air conditioning, and a huge percentage of American homes have air conditioning today. Most of the homes when I was a kid, the numbers, I've looked them up, said what was the level of home air conditioning in about 1973? So I would have been middle school about that time, or junior high, as they called it then. It would have been about 30% of homes had air conditioning, about 70% did not. Today, the percentage of homes, even homes below the poverty line that have air conditioning, is more than a majority, more than half, and it's actually fairly high. An awful lot of people enjoy air conditioning. So now, having worked your tail off to be able to afford to put in air conditioning and ready to pay the bill, along comes the government saying you'd help us all out if you just turn the temperature up to 78 degrees in your home when you're there and 85 degrees when you're not there. I would love to hear the naysayer who says that's what they plan to do. Oh, and by the way, they want you to set it for cold in the wintertime when it's cold outside. They want you to be similarly not air conditioned in the wintertime. And I think that's just crazy. To your calls now. Let's start with Debbie. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I don't get to listen very often, but I heard you a while ago talking about the all the forest fire situation and how they don't clear out the woods. And I was wondering if you were aware of the research study that's being done at OSU. They are going to study about how to keep the wine grapes from tasting smoky.
Oh, wow. They're actually going to study that. Well, now, let me ask you, I don't know if you know the details, is it to keep the wine grapes from, you know, from ingesting the smoke, which I understand they do very, very well. You know, when there's a fire, those wine grapes are going to soak up that smoke, and that's going to still be in the grapes when they're turned into wine. Are they trying to de-smokeify the grapes, or are they actually talking about trying to get the grapes not to ingest the smoky air? Do you know?
Ladder. I think it was trying to figure out how to get the grapes not to ingest the smoke. But of course, when I read this article, my first thought is, why don't we just go back to keeping the brush cleared out of the forest so we don't have forest fires at all to begin with?
You know, I don't want to shock you, Debbie, but you might be surprised to know that I absolutely agree with every word you said. And frankly, here's a great example of where if you had a little business and you hired somebody to manage the business and he did a terrible job or she did a terrible job, would you keep that person on the job?
Not at all.
No. So if you're the state, and the states of Oregon and Washington and maybe even Idaho to some extent do a terrible job of managing the force that all of us own, whether they're state, whether they're BLM, whether they're federal, whether they're Forest Service or national, you know, wilderness areas, whatever they are, they're all publicly owned. If we have people who've done a demonstrably terrible job of managing them, my suggestion would be fire them as the managers, number one. And if you say, well, who's going to do it instead? I'd say, well, why don't we look around the landscape at anybody who owns large amounts of timber privately and find out who they have managed and how they manage their forest. I could suggest a bunch of big timber companies, but you know the names, Weyerhaeuser and all the rest, and say, why don't we fire the entire state departments of forestry and use the money we save to hire some private companies, and maybe we can even work a smoking good deal by saying to those private companies, if you'll manage these forests, maybe we'll pay you part of the fee for your management services in cash, but we could also pay it to you in the form of trees. And, you know, we'll give you an equivalent amount if the price tag for managing our forests is $100 million. We'll give you $75 million worth of standing timber every year you manage it, which is probably a lot less than what would burn. And we'll pay the rest in cash. Do you think that I'd have any trouble finding a private company capable of doing that?
Not at all. I think they'd all be jumping at the chance. And, of course, the other thing is maybe they could just go back and remember what they did years ago.
Well, Debbie, it's one of the reasons I keep citing the work of Dr. Bob Zybeck, who documented from 1953 to 1988 in the entire Northwest, we had one fire of more than 40,000 acres in a given year. Now, that was the only big fire in those 33 years, one-third of a century with one moderately bad fire at 40,000 acres. And these days, if you look up the numbers, and if people don't believe me, look them up. The average acres burned every year in the state of Oregon is 500,000. And about the same amount of acreage burns in Washington State. And then in a bad year, 1 million acres burn. So in other words, we have, say, a bad fire year and 1 million acres burn, and that's equivalent to 30 times as much acreage burned as burned in that entire one-third of a century. You're absolutely right. There's a way to not just stop the problem of the smoke and not figure out how to get the grapes not to inhale when there's a fire going on. I don't know how you talk grapes into doing that, but if you said, hey, why don't we do this? We'll hire the big timber companies. They can manage the forest the same way they do with their private stands. And if they're not very good at it, we fire them and we hire somebody else. And they know that's the potential penalty. And in the meantime, let's cut a lot of trees. Let's turn it into lumber. Let's replant with baby trees. And everybody will be money ahead and smoke ahead as well. Debbie, thanks for the call. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. On the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court punted, well, worse than punted, I think they just threw the White House a gift. They said, we're going to let you keep on censoring what is said on social media in the last months before a presidential election this year. They've given free rein because they've said the folks behind the lawsuit that was brought was successful at the lower court levels, where the court said, you're right, we can't let the government censor what Americans have access to on social media and the big technology companies like Google, like Meta, like X or Twitter, if you will, or Facebook or any of the rest of that. You can't do that. Well, the Supreme Court says, well, it turns out you can. And there are a bunch of issues involved in that. So I thought it'd be a great time to talk to Josiah Joner, who is a recent graduate from Stanford University and editor-in-chief of the Stanford Review. Because, Josiah, welcome back. You've just written about the fact that Stanford's Internet Censorship Division is finally closing its doors. Or are we premature? They may take a look at this Supreme Court decision and say, no, no, we're going to keep the Stanford Internet Observatory open. What do you think?
No, thanks for having me back, Lars. No, I am extremely disappointed in the ruling today. The Supreme Court had the opportunity to say no to big tech, to say no to the Biden administration, to say no to censorship, and yes to free speech. But, however, they've let standing get in the way of good precedent this time. It's unfortunate, but, and I'm no legal expert, but if the Supreme Court can't put a stop to the censorship, then we have to continue pressuring and exposing these institutions for this censorship. We cannot let them, as Justice Alito said, control what the people say, hear, and think. And so we've been doing this at the Stanford Review for years now. And I'll tell you just a quick story, Lars. I remember earlier this year, I was walking in Stanford, one of my department buildings, and I was just walking through a room, and I happened to stumble into this large room, which sure enough was the Stanford Internet Observatory itself. And it's exactly what you would have expected. Cubicles, no windows, and bureaucrats. It's exactly what we expect of these institutions. They're not here putting the good of the American people or the good of our American principles first. They're instead concerned about pushing their own narrative and own agenda. And the only way to stop it is to continue pressuring and exposing these institutions like we've been doing the Stanford Review. And I think it's super important.
Well, the other thing I found scary, because I haven't read through Alito's entire dissent, but I quoted from some of it earlier, but part of this is kind of a warning shot across the bow of anybody who decides to bring a future lawsuit, assuming we have any First Amendment rights left in a couple of years. But they've said there's a traceability problem. And Josiah, I guess it'd work like this. If I walked into the studio tomorrow morning and thought, I think I'll talk about the debate tonight. And then, say, one of my bosses sends me an email and says, Lars, you ought to make sure you talk about the debate today. And then one of my producers says, Lars, we should definitely talk about the debate today. Which one of, if I finally talk about the debate on the show, did I do it because I thought of it before I walked in? Did I do it because one of my bosses said, hey, you ought to do that, which I was going to do anyway? Or did I do it because one of my brilliant producers suggested that I do it? They're saying if you can't prove traceability, and so when you have a government agency that says to, say, Meta, we really wish you'd take down that Facebook post because it's going to cause problems, and we're going to declare that it's misinformation. Now, the Meta can say, well, we did it because the FBI told us to, which might be the honest answer. Or they can say, we were going to do that anyway. And the Supreme Court has effectively, I think, suggested if you can't prove Meta or X or Facebook or Google or anybody else did something because a government agency told them to do it, if you can't prove that linkage, then you can't ever have a case.
Right, exactly. And I mean, that's the difficulty with this case here in the Supreme Court, and they do need the evidence to do that, and they threw it out based on standing. But I'll tell you, I mean, what we've seen from the Stanford Internet Observatory at Stanford is this. We have seen, you know, evidence that they have worked to censor, and I quote, true content which might promote vaccine hesitancy and stories of true vaccine side effects. So while the Supreme Court may have threw this out based on standing, the reality is that this institution, specifically at Stanford, has worked not to uphold the principles of free speech or prevent misinformation and disinformation. That's all a guise to push their narrative. And they have, we've seen some collaboration with these agencies. The Supreme Court wasn't able to rule it. But what we need to continue doing is saying that this is not okay. These institutions, if they need to stand for our basic American principles and these bedrock values, Stanford needs to do better. These schools need to do better. And frankly, the government needs to do better. But there's only one way to do that, and that's going to have to be in November.
Well, because imagine this. I'm talking to Josiah Joner, who's just graduated from Stanford, but he's the editor-in-chief of the Stanford Review. Believe it or not, there is a conservative newspaper on the Stanford University campus. But imagine what they're doing. They say, we, somebody, the government, the FBI, or all these other agencies, and the FBI has just confirmed to the Federalist, they are still engaged in this kind of activity, and they'll even admit it. They admitted it to the Federalist and to others. They said, right, look, we get to decide what is good information, what's bad. Well, take yourself back to the middle of the pandemic. If you say, well, we're going to have everybody mask up, and somebody says, no, masks don't work, which we now know is true. They don't work. But at the time, if you said they didn't work, you were declared to be engaging in misinformation. When the vaccine, so-called the mRNA jab, came out, and there were people saying there are bad side effects to that jab, and we were told, no, that's misinformation. Like you said, it would cause people to be hesitant about taking the vaccine because they were being told the truth about it. And you say, well, that's misinformation. We won't allow you to say that. That's holding back from people, and I think you made an important point when you said true information that somebody in the government finds inconvenient, even though it is, they will admit, true information, they just don't want people to hear it.
Exactly. And, you know, what's more, at Stanford, we had the scientists who were saying, no, this isn't right. We had Dr. Scott Atlas, and we have Dr. Scott Atlas, and we have Bhattacharya saying exactly that. And they were censored at their own institution. And so, like, what is going on if our top academic universities are now putting TM, trademark, next to science? That's one of the worst things you could have for this country. What we really need is true institutions that are really promoting the principles of academic freedom and free expression. That's how we can truly move science, truly make progress. But what we've seen at Stanford is the exact opposite of that. What they want to do is push a narrative and use it to do what they can to influence the narrative, influence elections, and influence what you can and can't think.
Well, I'm curious, Josiah, what you think is going to happen. The story you wrote was about the Stanford Internet Observatory shutting down, that it's coming to an end after 5 years. But given this new lifeblood from the Supreme Court with a bad decision, do you think they'll decide to fire it back up again?
Well, you know, the earlier report that they were shutting down, Stanford's come out and said and denied that. They were not shutting down, but that they are facing a funding crisis. So right now, what we can hope for is that they can't get their funding because no one's going to want to sponsor this attempt to, I guess, infiltrate democracy. But, I mean, we'll see. I think Stanford really has been going through changes. It's not been a good couple years for the university, but we have a new president coming in, and what we need are university leaders and administrators who are going to uphold free speech and say, you know what, this isn't actually what we want our university to be leading. This is not upholding these principles, which these universities are supposed to abide by, cherish, and share with everyone, a free expression, free speech, and academic freedom. So what we need to see is a change from the very top.
You know what I'm afraid of, Josiah? I think there are people out there who say somebody in the government should decide to shut this untrue speech down, or even this true speech that's right. Inconvenient. Unfortunately, some of those people have piles of money. And I worry that some of them might say, no. We want to fund that censorship. We're in favor of censorship. I mean, in communist China, censorship is actually very popular among most average folks. They say, we don't need all these troublesome other ideas. Just shut them down. That's Josiah Joner, just graduated from Stanford, still a conservative, and editor-in-chief at the Stanford Review. Summer is a
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the program. The X-Poll question today on the Lars Larson Show. Will the candidate's performance tomorrow night make any difference in your vote for president? I would say no to that. I think that an awful lot of people are going to say the same thing, although I kind of wonder, if you're a hardcore Democrat and you've already decided your vote this November will be for Joe Biden, if he shows up on the debate stage and ends up flopping the way he has at so many public events in the last few months, is that going to change your mind? Or are you going to say, I don't care how demented he is, I'm still going to vote for him? You can vote in the X poll at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Weldon, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network.
Thank you, Lars. Good to talk to you. Hey, I was thinking about that Surgeon General end around.
Yeah.
Why don't we use it against the criminals and say, well, you've been convicted of murder with a handgun, you get the death penalty automatically.
Yeah, I wish we could do that. And one of the things I always point out to people, Weldon, right now, public opinion polls show the vast majority of Americans, as many as 80% of Americans, believe in the death penalty for some crimes, for the worst of the worst, you know, the worst in homicides.
Well, if you want to solve the gun problem, you do it for a year. I mean, automatic capital punishment for a year, you get convicted and you get killed. No appeals, just go out and you get hung.
Well, the problem there, Weldon, is you just ran up against the Constitution, because everybody has a right to appeal their conviction. So don't ask for things that make me say, well, let's violate the Constitution. How's that?
Well, here's the deal. The jury system is an appeal system. You get 12 appeals in one shot.
That's a worthy point. I just don't think it would work legally, but I appreciate the suggestion. Look, would I like to see the death penalty for people who rape a child, as Florida has now? Yes. Would I like to see the death penalty for certain drug dealing offenses, as President Trump has suggested? Absolutely yes. Do I think it's going to work long term that way? Do I think you could convince the state lawmakers or the Congress to do it? That's going to be a tougher reach. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on a Wednesday. What's on your mind?
So I'm kind of a naysayer. 50-50 on an ace area.
Okay.
On the thermostat setting. So my dog in the fight is I'm an HVAC contractor. I've been doing it for 18 years.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'm going to admit to you is I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. So with that being said, the thermostat settings, I kind of agree with them on that. So if you set your thermostat for 70 degrees and it's 85 outside, when the system is working properly, it's pulling humidity out of the air, you feel comfortable.
Yep.
In a 100-degree weather, if you set your thermostat for 78 and it's working right and cooling, you are going to feel comfortable when you walk into your home because it's pulling humidity out of the air and you have a 22-degree temperature split between outside and inside. It will work. Am I going to do it? Oh, heck no. But
in fact, you're the HVAC guy. What's your, when it's warm in the summertime, what do you set the inside temperature at your house?
My thermostat during the summer is always set to 70 degrees.
And 70 degrees.
I have super energy efficient equipment that's variable speed, that's inverter driven, that it does a very good job of keeping that home comfortable. Will it work? How they're saying to do that, if that equipment's working properly, it's sized properly, absolutely will it work. But it should just be on a voluntary basis. I work my butt off during the day. I'm out sweating, doing my thing. I want to come home. I want to be comfortable. My thermostat will never change from 70 degrees. I know a little bit more than the average Joe. Mine will always stay on 70 degrees.
Well, and Steve, I would love to see how much, if you took two houses and you set one to 85 during the day, but then have the person bring it down to 70 when they get home. So you've let the house be hot all day long while you're gone, 8 or 10 hours, and then you walk in and bring the temperature down. Even if you have one that will work on a timer where you can say, you know, 15 minutes before I usually get to home, I want the air conditioning to come on and bring the temp down. I'd like to know how much of a difference that's going to make in the average bill, because this is how the EPA is trying to sell it, say, you're going to save some money. Yeah, you'll save some. I don't imagine it's going to be a lot.
You will save some, but having a well-designed size system maintain a temperature is going to save you far more energy and money in the long run than setting it to 85 and dropping it down to 70 when you get home, because that system's got to work its butt off to get that home down to 70 degrees from 85.
And if you let it get to, say, to 90, and then you say, now I'd like it to be at 70 when I get home, do I have a good chance of freezing up the coils in the heat exchanger?
You have no idea how many calls we get because of just that.
I know, because people say, I'm going to save a dollar by leaving it really hot in my house, and then when I get home, I'm going to crank that thing down, and we're going to bring that temperature down. And all of a sudden, all that outside humidity freezes up around your coils, and the repair guy on the phone says, yeah, open your doors, let it get to about 90 inside, and when your coils unfreeze a few hours from now, then you'll be able to get cool again. Steve, thanks very much. The Lars